many of you have probably already heard of the Four Noble Truths. And once we've heard them and perhaps memorized them, you think, right, I've got that. Could you give me the next teaching, please? The next stage. We did the Four Truths last year. What about the Eight Truths? 10 Truths? I know that suffering thing, but what about Tantra? Oh, come on. Suffering. But that's for beginners. Yes, it's a good idea to memorize them, but only so that you can refer to them. They're mirrors. They help us keep reflecting, looking freshly at this present moment. So that we approach this moment more clearly, more wisely. We have all sorts of views, opinions, ways of thinking about this moment, about me, about you, about the world, which are upside down, which are deluded, which are wrong. The Buddha taught to his disciples, because of not understanding these four things, I, like you, have wandered endlessly through this round of birth and death and birth and death and birth and death, through not understanding these four things. In the language of the Buddha, they're called Arya Satcha. Satcha, truth. Arya, noble. But they're not things that you can grasp and put in your pocket as possessions. Perhaps it would be better to call them ennobling truths. In other words, in the process of contemplating these truths, we become more noble. They ennoble us. They make our heart more expansive, more profound, more wise, more clear. Oftentimes it is said that these four Noble Truths were the first sermon that the Buddha taught, the first teaching. But actually, our teachers like to remind us that actually the Buddha's first sermon was a flop. Flop. Didn't work. The Buddha recounted later on, after he was awakened. Remember when I said the other night that when the Buddha-to-be, when he hadn't yet realized the truth and he was struggling and he questioned, might there be another way, when he was just torturing himself, and he had the memory of the child. He remembered that pleasure and thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure? The pleasure of withdrawing, of stabilizing, welcoming, and being at one with the simplicity of this body breathing. And he thought, yes, this is the way. This is not harmful. But I need to eat something. So he ate something. He actually received a gift. Before, he was only taking like a few rice grains a day. He even reduced it down to one a day. He was almost dead. When he decided that he needed to strengthen his body, then there was a maiden, a lovely young woman nearby who wanted to make an offering, and he accepted it. She offered him something like rice pudding, which was considered at the time, his fellow ascetics, the five ascetics that were with him, thought, Gotama, we were staying with you because you were number one. No one could take pain like you. No one could torture yourself like you. No one could suffer like you. But now, accepting ice cream, basically, rice pudding, and from a girl, and probably a beautiful girl. So they just shook their heads and said, he's backsliding, he's taking the route of luxury. You know, he's eating, so he's taking the route of luxury. So they abandoned him. But the young seeker had confidence in his, so he accepted that. Didn't say, but I doubt if he had 10 bowls, 20 bowls. Probably tasted good, but he took what he needed. He regained strength. He cultivated calm, peace, clarity. And then he didn't just indulge in that, meaning indulge. He didn't just try to hang out forever there. He then used that clarity to look into the nature of things. And he had his awakening. And after he was awakened to that which is peaceful, truly peaceful, and never dies, he spent days just appreciating the bliss of deliverance, being delivered from suffering, delivered from endless birth and death. And it is said that a wanderer, another seeker, came by and noticed the newly enlightened Buddha, noticed his features were bright, luminous, radiant, serene. And this wanderer approached the Buddha and said, your faculties are serene, they're bright. Who is your teacher? You know, like, you look pretty good. I'd like to be like that. And the Buddha said that he said something like, I haven't memorized it, so forgive me, I don't know. But he said something like, I am the all-awakened one, world conqueror. Awakened through my own efforts. What need have I of a teacher? Something like that. It was a lion's roar. It was like he was speaking from the truth. He found it himself. He didn't have a teacher. But the guy that heard it shook his head and said, fine for you. And he sort of walked off in the other direction. That's what it said. It said he took another road. So we like to think that his first talk was a flop. He gave a talk of a lion's roar of, I've done it. I'm the awakened one. I'm peaceful. I've discovered the sublime truth. But in terms of a skillful means for someone else to come on board, you know, either they can say, well, I believe you, that's great, or I don't believe you. There's sort of not a lot of gateways there. And so it doesn't say it, but our teachers are telling us that Then when he thought, who will understand this, and was thinking of his five previous buddies, his friends, who had abandoned him for being soft, that on the way from Bodh Gaya, where he was awakened, to walking in stages to Sarnath near Benares, where he saw through his inner vision that his former colleagues were staying, he reconsidered how to present this. He had discovered a truth that's peaceful, undying. But, I mean, he could have said Nibbana. Say after me, Nibbana. With more confidence. Nibbana. Nope, you're not putting your heart into it. After me, little more guts. Come on, like you mean it. Nibbana. I believe in Nibbana. Come on, you're not really giving yourself to it. Come on, a little more. I think I'm getting there. I believe in Nibbana. He could have taken that route, and then I don't know if I would be here. Maybe I would. I do come from the South, and there is quite a tradition. There's quite a tradition of another approach. And, but you can believe, but you're saying a word that you don't know. We might have a trust that there is such a thing as peace. There's a certain trust that we don't know yet, but that's having us here, but we don't really know it. So one could keep convincing oneself about it, but we don't know that yet. And so in this, when he thought about how to present this, when he approached his disciples, they saw him coming. And they said, there's the softy, look, he's coming, backslider. But after all, he was our friend. Look, he can sit down if he wants, but just don't wash his feet, no special treatment. But as he got closer, he was so radiant that they couldn't help themselves. They sort of did receive him. But then when he sat down and said, look, I've discovered the truth, let me teach you, they wouldn't believe him. They didn't want to hear anything because they had a view. Guys that eat milk rice from girls don't have truth. That was a view. That's not a big view nowadays. But in those days, if you were an ascetic and you were into being tough, you don't do things like that. So they wouldn't look at it. He said once, he said twice, he said three times. They said, no way. And then he said, have I ever spoken this way before? Have you ever heard me say that I have discovered the truth, the sublime truth? Have you ever heard me talk this way? If you listen carefully and apply your minds, you can discover just what I've discovered. You can recognize what I've recognized. They then listened. And then he unfolded this teaching on the Four Noble Truths. The first truth is there is suffering. There is suffering. Second truth, there is a cause of suffering. Third truth, there is a cessation of suffering. Suffering ends. Fourth truth, there's a path that leads to the cessation of suffering. This is in the form similar to the way the doctors would diagnose an illness in those days. The Ayurvedic system talks about an illness, the diagnosis, dukkha. There is a condition that is afflicted, suffering. There's a cause for this illness, It's the second ennobling truth. What is the prognosis? There's a cure. The third truth is there is a cure. There's an ending of this illness. What is the fourth truth? There's a medicine. There's that which you apply yourself to, which leads to this cure. Dukkha, first truth. What is dukkha? When Tanisra touched on it this morning. At first, he listed very tangible things. Birth is dukkha. Just roughly, it can mean that which is not easy to deal with, not easy to bear. Birth can be painful, both for the mother, for the child, for those watching who are concerned. How's it going to go? Birth is dukkha. Aging is dukkha. Sickness is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Being united with what you don't want to be with. Being separated from what you cherish. What you really love. Being parted from that, in other words. Not getting what you want. And the five focuses of the grasping mind. This is just a category of the eight kinds of dukkha. But these aren't esoteric, far off, really. You don't need a PhD in philosophy to get the feeling of how birth can be not easy to bear. Sickness. This retreat, there's been a lot of sickness. People going through rolls of toilet paper with all sorts of water coming out here, inflammation there, sneezing there. Some have talked about diarrhea, water coming out here, water coming out there. Watching the breath, but having, you know, it cough and lurch. Not being able to go to sleep. Not being able to wake up. This is not deep esoteric stuff, but can we sense how having a fever is dukkha? It's not easy to bear a fever. It's not easy to bear old age. I'm just 55, but I get up in the morning and I have a mantra. I'm trying to let go of this mantra. But sometimes I get up in the morning and my immediate mantra from ancient past lives is, it's too difficult. And then Tanisra will say, it's too difficult. Then we have a mantra in harmony. It's too difficult. It's too difficult. It is difficult. My back hurts. My kidneys ache. Let's sleep a little while longer. It's not a deep esoteric truth. Sometimes waking up with a body that is just so old. Feels so old. Notice the Buddha said, there is dukkha. He didn't say, you guys are suffering. I'm out of there. I'm free, but poor you guys. No, that would have put them on the defensive. You know, kind of limiting. He just said, there is dukkha. There's a gate there you can go through. It's reasonable. It's true that there is dukkha. Yeah, I think there are things that are tough to bear. And then the next part of the list is even easier, being united with what you don't want to be with. You want to be peaceful and you got a mind full of barking dogs. Dogs bark outside, dogs bark inside. That's dukkha. Being separated from the loved. What you really want to be with. Your beloved one. That which you cherish. whether it's a person, a friend, an animal, a state of mind. Maybe you had a meditation where you were really peaceful and you're separated from it. I know a guy for 5 years, he was trying to get back to a meditation he had. 5 years. That's dukkha. That is dukkha. Now, he didn't, in each of these noble truths, suffering, the cause, the cessation, the path, has a duty. A duty. The Buddha didn't just say, accept everything. He didn't just say one thing. We talk different things to bring us back into balance, but actually the Buddha gave duties in reference to different sorts of circumstances. Suffering, he said, needs to be understood. So he listed these things, some of which are very obvious, tangible, that we struggle with. Birth, old age, sickness, death. United with what we don't want to be with, parted from the loved, not getting what we want. And the eighth one, the focuses of the grasping mind. So this includes difficult, really grossly difficult things like sickness, aching body. It also can include subtle stuff, just being uneasy. Not able to settle. Not quite being able to put your finger on it. All of this range from the painful to the subtle needs to be understood. That means suffering, the worldly answer to suffering is get rid of it. Have you tried one of these? Pill. Pills are nice. Sometimes they can help us with pain. But the worldly answer to suffering is you get away from it as quick as you can. And sometimes even to survive as children. If a child is crying on a train and in a situation where sometimes, just for the sake of convenience, the mother will pull the keys out of her pocket or the father and just jangle them. The child's crying about something, but it sees something shiny, something glittering, and forgets. Huh. That's an expedient temporary measure that can be very helpful. But as we get older, sometimes we do that. We meet something difficult and then we look for something else. We move away from it. That can lead to endless suffering. But this ennobling truth is when there's suffering. So suffering is something the Buddha said we need to hold on to. Not forever. Not cling to it. But he's saying it's a gateway. So sometimes when you use words like accept things, we're not. Yes, when one looks closer, they become different from what we thought they were. But accept things is a useful instruction when we compulsively run away from how things are. You can't see how things really are if we're so busy assuming that we have to get away from it. The instruction, suffering needs to be understood, means you encourage yourself to stand under, to open to welcome, to be with, so that we can comprehend it. This is very different. And it changes. At first, when we're open to suffering, it shouldn't be this way, it shouldn't be this way, it shouldn't be this way. This is suffering, this is suffering. if we stay with it, is the possibility of noticing what is causing it, what is feeding it, what is sustaining it. Just the process of being willing to be with sickness already, that ennobles the heart. The heart then becomes able to bear pain. It becomes more compassionate, because in bearing with pain, compassion means to suffer with. It means our heart is able to hold that which is painful. If we think pain is suffering, and then we just try to get away from pain, then that means that we think pleasure is the end of suffering. That's an assumption that we can have. So we look for the nice sights, go for the nice tastes. But what happens? If that's the case, then maybe if you like ice cream is the end of suffering. One scoop, two scoops, five scoops of ice cream. How much ice cream can you eat? And what then you like then starts becoming, how long can we look at a beautiful sight? Our eyes get tired, the sight changes. Even that which is pleasing is dukkha. We don't notice that unless we're willing to stay with the present moment. That's why we've been practicing steadying ourselves, being mindful these first few days. If we just said, let go. If you don't know what you're letting go of, how can you let go?
A lot of suffering.
We don't know what we're letting go of. How can we let go? This last definition of dukkha is the focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. This is the most subtle one. What does the mind grasp at? What does the mind reach for and try to hold on to? What we think of as the world, what we think of as me. The Buddha said there are categories, there are aspects of what we call me. There's body, there's form. There's feelings, sensations, liking and not liking. There's perceptions, impulses, consciousness. These are all part of me that we take to be, that we grasp at. The Buddha says, what we're grasping at is dukkha. Well, what does that mean? Have you ever had a new car? I had this experience, it wasn't really mine, but I had to rent a car to get here. I was with my mother dying and everything. I was quite busy before coming. I was teaching a retreat in Africa, and I got the days wrong on my ticket, and I suddenly realized I had to get to the airport by 6 o'clock the next morning, so I had to quickly rent a car. And the guy at the place said, anything happens to this car, you have to pay all this money. In Africa, cars have, because there's in Africa, there are specialists at stealing cars. It's a big industry. So oftentimes on the cars in Africa, there's an alarm, a lock, an immobilizer, a gear lock, a anti-hijack. There's just all sorts of things. You wouldn't expect a flamethrower in a car. But so anyway, I was renting a car, and they tell me if something happens to it, I pay a lot of money, but they didn't have any security on it. I said, that's crazy. At least find one that, that locks properly with something. So anyway, I'm driving it to the airport, and then when I'm parking it, I'm thinking, oh dear, if something happens, any scratches on the car, I've got to pay for them. So I'm going in and looking, get it farther from that car. Normally if I see a scratch on a car, there's nothing. Oh, there's a scratch on that car. You don't feel anything scratch. But what about a scratch on my car? My car. My new car. It's a new car. And you suddenly see a big scratch on it. What's going on there? What's that feeling? Suffering. It's dukkha. Why didn't we suffer when we saw the scratch on that other car? Just a scratch. Car scratch. I mean, you live with it. But my car. You go around and you see a tree get cut down somewhere. It's a tree that's cut down. Okay. But what if it's in my orchard? My tree. My money. My body. Someone else has a blemish on your face. You think, oh, it's a blemish. So what? It is as it is. Look in the mirror in the morning. There's a big blemish. My face. So focus is of the grasping mind. When we take something to be me, where does that come from? That comes from within. An assumption that this is me. It's not the way I want it. So if we take something to be me, that means we're expecting it to be mine. To be certain. This process of taking things to be me, the Buddha called upadana. He gave a visual image. It's like climbing on top of something. Upadana means to climb on. That's called clinging. And then when you climb onto something, the Buddha used, that leads to what the Buddha called bhava, becoming, which leads to birth. It seems to be me. Okay, if what you climb onto, then you're supported by that. If I climb onto a table and the table collapses, there's a sense of me collapsing. If I tie myself to the car, chain myself to my new car, so I can always see what's going on with it. If the car moves, then I get drug after it. When you tie yourself to something, when you we cling to things that seem to be solid, that seem to be mine, that seem to be me. Why are the five focuses of the grasping mind dukkha? Well, what have we noticed in our vipassana? We've made all kinds of assumptions about the world. I'd like to be at peace. I would like to be in harmony with all beings. That's just a thought. But when we're doing vipassana, looking into, not through someone else's opinion, but using our own capacity to see clearly, when we start looking into these aggregates of existence, body, feeling, perception, impulses, consciousness, what do we notice? The body sounds like a thing, but actually it's breathing in, breathing out. Its energy changes all the time. However you say it is, the next instant our body's different. We call it me, But does it take orders from us? Whose body asked for permission to get this flu? Did anybody's body write you an email and say, excuse me, can I get the flu? I can put it off till next week if you like, if it's not convenient. Or I'll go over to the other one over there. Did the body ask for permission to get old? Excuse me, do you mind if I have a backache tomorrow? I won't last too long. The body, we call it me. But it follows its own laws. And actually, it is the nature of the body, breathing in, breathing out. The nature of the body to grow old and sick and die. The nature of the dawn, the beautiful dawn, the sun's coming up, to turn into the midday, to turn into the dusk. It's the nature to be cold and then hot. It's the nature of feeling to be pleasant and then painful. So if we cling on to, and take our stand, calling this me and mine a pleasant feeling, we're building our house on quicksand. You know the word quicksand? It is no foundation. It's uncertain. It's like building our house on health. It's nice to be healthy. It's beautiful to be healthy and energetic. But if we then cling and assume this is me, we just assume, then when there's sickness, there's death. That's called birth. And then when there's sickness, there's death. All of this we don't understand if we're not willing to be with the dukkha, be with the aches, be with the pain, be with the pleasure. And when we start to see everything is anicca, forms and feelings and thoughts are changing. Something that's changing is not reliable. I'm not saying it's bad. The Buddha didn't say it's bad. But it's not a place where you find security. Its nature is to break down. Like the thoughts of this talk. The thoughts of this talk. My thoughts are there, but then they keep breaking down. Another thought comes, and then it breaks down. Another thought arises, and then it breaks down. Another day comes, and then it ceases. If we grasp at something and expect it to be different, wouldn't it be nice if the full moon stayed full all the time? Wouldn't it be nice if I was just healthy all the time? Wouldn't it be nice if everybody liked me all the time? Wouldn't it be nice if I felt pleasant all the time? Those are the thoughts of a child that's not in touch. They're not evil thoughts. But when we have wisdom, the moon is full and then it goes dark. There's pleasant feeling and it becomes painful. Your most favorite food, if you keep eating it, you get full. You can't say it's good. It's good in the right amount. Can't even say water's good. It's good when you're thirsty, too much, and you drown. But not knowing this, when we look for security, our teacher said looking for security in the conditioned world is bound to bring a lot of suffering. Even the Buddha, Moses, King Solomon. Rich people, poor people, face praise and blame, success and failure. The Buddha had a flop. He could have said, oh God, my teaching career, let's face it. Look, I know I'm peaceful, but you know, come on. He could have. Some people got it real wrong. He had disciples that were making trouble. He had cousins trying to kill him. He had people accusing him of all kinds of things. But he also had people that understood. He got sick. He got attacked and even got injured. He felt pain. But he didn't suffer. So, wait a minute. What do you mean he felt pain and didn't suffer? If you cling to pleasure and think it should be this way all the time, then you get born into that. Then when it changes, we feel shaken. When there isn't that clinging, then the pain was just pain. It was painful, but he could be peaceful with it. So in opening to suffering so that we can comprehend it, we start to see the cause of suffering. Stress comes from clinging, wanting things to be a certain way. It comes from a deluded idea that there's something that we can just freeze. It comes from this childish notion that wouldn't it be nice if the river flowed the other way? It is the way it is. So the second ennobling truth is suffering has a cause, this desire and clinging, trying to keep things a certain way. The Buddha said we have a duty with reference to that too. Suffering needs to be understood. That clinging, thirsting desire, trying to pin down the world, needs to be abandoned, let go of. Some things need to be open to. When we find ourselves wanting this, wanting that, so when we're with pain and suffering and we find ourselves wanting it to go away, can we see how that's creating more suffering? What if we let go just in a moment of not craving it to be otherwise? In a moment of being able to meet it just as it is. It is as it is, but we notice another dimension. The Buddha said this third truth, the ending of suffering, is something that needs to be realized. We need to know it. It's a moment of knowing. And what leads to this realization of the end of suffering? The path of mindfulness, the path of virtue, the path of gatheredness and samadhi, what's called the Eightfold Path. So suffering is not an ultimate truth. Those who think Buddhism is about misery. No, the Buddha said there is suffering. When certain things are in place, we create suffering. When we're clinging and wanting things to be a certain way, we create suffering. In a moment, when we abandon that clinging, there still might be a pain. There still might be a circumstance that we wouldn't necessarily choose. But we wake up to something different. We wake up to a peace. Looking for stability in the world of change is a cause of suffering. This sounds like a paradox, but the more we open to the change, deeply accept and know moment to moment, not just intellectually, know moment to moment. For example, the change of my voice. Sounds are changing all the time. sounds are coming and going. And just as these sounds are coming and going, every feeling is the same way. Every thought is the same way. Every mood is the same way. In a moment of really noticing, being with, understanding change, we start to touch the changeless. We start to meet that which doesn't move, that which is still. Each thought and sound dissolves back into presence, dissolves back into silence, dissolves back into stillness. When we're so focused on the particulars of life, on those things that we take to be me, focused on my body, my family, my loved ones, my property, my opinions, trying to control that and being stressful as it's shifting, we think that is real. Yes, it's real to a certain extent. But it's as if we were looking at the surface of the sea, only looking at the waves. Oh, there's a big wave. Look at that one. With a white crest on top. A good surfing wave. Powerful wave. Oh, there's a smaller wave. That looks safer to swim on. Ooh, there's beautiful little ripples. We only look at the surface. We can give names to the waves. Ooh, there's a tidal wave. Tsunami wave. Dangerous wave. But when the wave crashes on the rock, we don't burst into tears, most of us. Oh, that wave, it was so beautiful in the prime of its life. Just shattered. Mother Nature is cruel. Mother Nature just is cruel. Did you see that beautiful wave? Just, oh dear, I better go have a cup of coffee. And someone else says, hey, look, get over it. That's your way of perceiving. That actually, that's water. Those waves, what you call the big wave, the small wave, the medium wave, look deeper. Yes, they're waves, but that's a way of talking. They all come together in the depth of the ocean. Nothing's dying. What you called, your perception grasped onto that form. What you grasp onto then changes. That's what happens. Hadn't thought about it that way. The Buddha taught Amato Gada Sabbe Dhamma. All things come together in the deathless. All things merge. Merge means things seem to be separate. Ooh, there's a lot of people in here. Where do all of us merge and come together? Where do the waves of the sea merge? It's our perception that has imagined they're all separate. We look differently and we see they come together in the depth. Similarly to the trees. Ooh, there's a, I don't know the names of the trees here. Olive trees. There's palm trees. Oh, I like the olive trees. They're useful. Palm trees aren't so bad. They have coconuts. But those with the thorns on there, no. Don't know about those. I like those. I don't like those. All those so-called separate trees, where do they come together? They merge. Oops. They merge in the earth. The ground. When consciousness is focused on externals, and then by the nature of perception, we think this and this. But all this and this keep arising and merging in consciousness and awareness. Only by being willing to look more closely do we see how we create this sense of separateness with thought. That actually all these apparent differences are part of one totality. How do we practice this? We practice noticing the way things are. Noticing thoughts and sounds as they change. Noticing them as they cease, as they end. Where is the place where everything comes together? Where does each sound return to? Each thought? Noticing the silence around the thoughts. The silence before each thought. The knowing, listening, silent awareness that is aware of each thing that comes and goes. We can let things come and go, but when we're not clinging, not grasping or pushing them away, things change. If you just allow the thoughts of my mind to come and go, don't try to hold them. The thoughts are moving, but our heart can be peaceful because we're resting. We're resting in the ground, the depth. We can get to know this place by letting go of clinging. How do we know we're clinging? When there's suffering. Suffering needs to be opened to, understood. Clinging needs to be abandoned. Peacefulness needs to be realized. The path that leads to this peacefulness needs to be cultivated. Just what we're doing on this retreat, cultivating mindfulness of sitting, mindfulness of walking, mindfulness of speaking, mindfulness of acting. A young student approached the Buddha. His name is Kappa. He said to the Buddha, "Sir, there are people stuck midstream in the terror and the fear of the rush of the river of becoming. Birth, death, decay, overwhelm them. For the sake of all these suffering beings, sir, tell me where to find an island. Where is there solid ground beyond the reach of all this pain?" "Kappa," said the master, "for the sake of all those people stuck in the middle of the river of becoming, overwhelmed by death and decay, I will tell you where to find solid ground. There is an island which you cannot go beyond. It is a place of no thingness, a place of non-possession, of non-attachment. It is the total end of death and decay. This is why I call it Nibbana. There are people who in mindfulness have realized this and are completely cool here and now. They do not become slaves working for death, working for Mara. They cannot fall into his power. A place of non-possession. This idea of ownership. It's just a way of talking. Actually, everything belongs to nature, to Dhamma. In a moment of giving back, letting be, letting go, in a moment of allowing that which arises to cease, the thoughts, the words, the feelings, in a moment of non-clinging, we can wake up to the peacefulness that is our true nature. Peacefulness that has no form, but which is solid, trustworthy, secure, inherent within our own being. Our true nature is not suffering. Our true nature is not pain. Pain and suffering arises and ceases. Let's cherish these four ennobling truths as mirrors which can help us look freshly, open to this experience of being alive again, for the sake of realizing the end of suffering.
Mm-hmm.